This is November 4th, 2012, and with the national election just 2 days from now, I thought I would make this Teisho about politics, political choices, and without getting partisan, and to appreciate what is beyond our differences, if I can. I'm going to be reading from several articles and a book that many of you I know have heard of called The Social Animal by David Brooks. The subtitle of this book, The Social Animal, is The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. The book jacket, the inside of the book jacket, outlines it this way. This is the story of how success happens. It is told through the lives of one composite American couple, Harold and Erica, how they grow, push forward, are pulled back, fail, and succeed. Distilling a vast array of information into these two vividly realized characters, Brooks illustrates a fundamental new understanding of human nature. A scientific revolution has occurred. We have learned more about the human brain in the last 30 years than we had in the previous 3,000. The unconscious mind, it turns out, is most of the mind. Not a dark, vestigial place, but a creative and enchanted one where most of the brain's work gets done. This is the realm of emotions, intuitions, biases, longings, genetic predispositions, personality traits, and social norms. The realm where character is formed and where our most important life decisions are made. It's also the realm of politics and political choices, as we'll hear. So he made up these two characters, Harold and Erica, who get married and come from very different backgrounds, and he uses this as a device to show how much we are affected by our conditioning and a lot of other stuff that we're not very much aware of. I'm going to have to ask people to forgive me for this probably not being the most organized Teisho. I was trying to braid together all kinds of things and maybe overreached a little bit, but I hope people can just appreciate what might be there in spite of the disorganization. There's a lot in this book, a lot more than about politics. The political part is just about 20 pages in the middle of the book. He talks about how this Harold, this fictitious Harold, joined a campaign, and what he saw during the campaign certainly didn't fit the rationalist model of politics, in which voters carefully weigh programs and pick the candidate with the policies that serve their interests. Instead, it fit the social identity model. People favor the party that seems to be filled with the sort of people they like and admire. I should say that David Brooks is known by some as an aggregator, that he does a lot of reading, and for those of us who don't do that much reading, he can synthesize a lot of what he's read, a lot of books that make it more understandable what's going on. I'm going to read, before I go back to his own book, I'm going to read a review of the book that appeared in Newsweek in March of last year, 2011. The author of the Newsweek review, James Atlas, says its thesis can be stated simply: who we are is largely determined by the hidden workings of our unconscious minds. Everything we do in life, the careers we choose, even on a deeper level, the way we experience and perceive the sensation of being alive, and this is where it gets into a Buddhist perspective, emerges from an infinitely complex neuronal network sending out signals that, largely unknown to us, assess and determine our behavior. So really, one title that would consider for this Teisho would be those lines from Affirming Faith in Mind that we chant: things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. That it's the premise of meditation, which is that the mind determines our experience of reality. The mind, that is the way we use or misuse the mind, determines our perceptions and our whole experience of reality. That there is no out there. There's no abstract world apart from how we process things with the mind. It's a very humbling way to understand what we call reality or truth, and it very much affects our political biases. Insights, information, responses to stimuli are governed by our emotions, a rich repository of thoughts and feelings that courses just beneath the surface of our conscious minds. They are mental sensations that happen to us. He's quoting, the author of the review is quoting David Brooks, mental sensations that happen. That's pure Buddhism. In early Buddhism, there is this term, mental formations. Everything is mental formations. Which doesn't mean that it's all illusion in some kind of absolute sense, but that we cannot separate our perceptions from the mind, the nature of the mind and how we're using it. And this is where it gets into what went into this book. Brooks has absorbed and synthesized a tremendous amount of scholarship. He has mastered the literature on child development, sociology, and neuroscience, the classics of modern sociology, the major philosophers from the Greeks to the French philosophers, the economists from Adam Smith to Robert Schiller. He quotes artfully from Coleridge and Stendhal, and there's nothing showy about it. He's been busy working on the book over the past 3 years during the stray hours when he isn't writing his column, appearing on TV, or lecturing around the country. Some of you may know him from the Friday afternoon All Things Considered, or one of those NPR programs, late afternoon, where he debates E.J. Dionne. Brooks takes the more conservative side, and Dionne, of course, the more liberal side. There are those who might look at ways that Brooks is not liberal enough, and I could be one of them, but what I appreciate him, admire in him, and his ability to try to look at both sides and to appreciate that there is something beyond simple right and wrong or black and white. I think he does that. He seems like a decent person to me from what I've seen of him. I just learned from Gerardo Sensei, one of my disciple teachers who lives in Mexico, that he has met David Brooks a couple of times. Brooks spent many years living in Mexico which endears me to him, right? Just that much would endear me to him. But he used to visit Gerardo's mother, and that's how Gerardo got to know him. The reviewer here, a little more, he says, in essence, The Social Animal is a book about the need for human connection, friendship, and love. What Brooks identifies as limerence. Behind the elaborate theorizing is Brooks' desire to articulate a universal feeling that all of us are caught up in what he calls the loneliness loop. We yearn for community. We have the urge to merge. When two people are having an intense conversation, their breathing synchronizes. Laughing together creates a feeling of joy. Soldiers drilling in unison experience a surge of power. What drives us ultimately is the need to be understood by others. Well, you know, this is the experience of awakening. It's the experience of Zazen, that we are fundamentally all of one mind. And these political and other divisions can obscure that and can really create all kinds of unnecessary conflict and ill will. So we're reading from the book about how these political campaigns fit the social identity model. People favor the party that seems to be filled with the sort of people they like and admire. There is a I'm going to go off on another tangent here. There is a psychiatrist, Drew Weston, who's done a lot of work in the process of political decisions and political affiliation. He says there's overwhelming evidence that three things determine how people vote. Three things determine how people vote. First, their feelings toward the parties and their principles. Their feelings toward the parties and their principles. Number two, their feelings toward the candidates themselves. And then only third, if they haven't decided yet, comes their feelings toward the candidates' policy positions. Back to Brooks' book, The Social Animal, he says, he quotes these political scientists in a book from a book called Partisan Hearts and Minds, that most people either inherit their party affiliations from their parents or they form an attachment to one party or another early in adulthood. Few people switch parties once they hit middle age. So this is a revised view of what I learned when I was in college. I minored in political science. I've always had a lot of interest in politics, and at that time they were reporting that it was pretty much however your parents were affiliated politically, you just inherit that. But this is now that you can change, and as I did certainly, from Rush Limbaugh Republican parents, you can change in early adulthood, but you're not likely too much after that. Brooks continues, once they have formed an affiliation, people bend their philosophies and their perceptions of reality so they become more and more aligned with members of their political tribe. Earlier this year, I gave a couple of consecutive teshos on tribalism and the many forms of racism and other forms of tribalism. Or I touched on this. So party affiliation often shapes values, not the other way around. And then he says, party affiliation even shapes people's perceptions of reality. And he reports on a 1960 study, became a classic text. It was called The American Voter, in which they argued that partisanship serves as a filter. A partisan filters out facts that are inconsistent with the party's approved worldview and exaggerates facts that confirm it. Over the years, some political scientists have criticized that observation, but many researchers are coming back to Campbell's conclusions. People's perceptions are blatantly biased by partisanship. I think this has become so obvious to many people who are hearing this, Taisho, we don't need to say anything more about that. He says here that he reports other research, and this is heavily research-based, this book. Of course, we can always say that Brooks is bringing his own biases to this, and undoubtedly he is, but the question is, to what degree? We all bring biases to things. But he seems to be exceptionally aware and conscious of that very danger, and that's why I trust much of what he says here. Not to mention that he's not putting out his opinion. He's largely it's based on studies and other research. Here's one: educated voters may be more factually right most of the time, but they are still factually wrong a significant amount of the time. They are actually less willing to correct their false opinions than less informed voters because they're so confident they are correct about everything. Since I think I'm speaking to a relatively well-informed group, this is something for all of us to consider. The overall impression one gets from this work is that the search for a candidate is an aesthetic search, a search for a candidate who clicks. Some of the things that influence a voter's decisions can be instantaneous and seemingly unimportant. As noted earlier, so-and-so and others at Princeton showed their research subjects black and white photographs of the faces of rival political candidates. The subjects were asked which of the candidates looked more competent. And then it says the subjects were not familiar with either of the candidates. So the candidate who was perceived as the more competent by the people looking at the photographs won 72% of the actual Senate races in which they were involved and 67% of the actual House races. The research subjects could impressively predict the actual winners even if they were given just 1 second to look at the candidates' faces. This result has been replicated internationally as well. In one study called Looking Like a Winner, so-and-so and others gave people in the United States and India quick glimpses of people running for office in Mexico and Brazil. Despite ethnic and cultural differences, the Americans and the Indians agreed about which candidate would be more effective. The American and Indian preferences also predicted the Mexican and Brazilian election results with a surprising accuracy. Yeah, there's a lot here that I have to, even just in these 20 pages, a lot I have to skip. Here's just a very short thing. There were consultants all around honing the message. Never say families, say working families. Never say spend, say invest. These subtle word alterations were used to provoke entirely different associations in voters' minds. Harold, this fictitious Harold, concluded that all the campaign trivialities were really triggers. They served to trigger deep chains of associations in people's minds. This one candidate would spend an hour getting photographed at a flag factory. The event was stupid on its face, but somehow the sight of him holding all those American flags triggered some set of unconscious associations. Another day, they put him on a stool and he held a rally in Monument Valley where all those John Wayne Westerns were set. It was a tacky device, but it triggered another set of associations. Each position about, say, energy policy was really a way of illuminating values of nature and community and human development. Positions were simply triggers for virtues. One day, John's opponent went hunting. Acts like these activated networks in voters' minds, too. Hunting meant guns, which meant personal freedom, which meant traditional communities, which meant conservative social values, which meant reverence for family and reverence for God. The next day, he ladled soup in a soup kitchen. The soup kitchen visit meant charity, which meant compassion, which meant a craving for social justice, which meant understanding the losers in the great game of life, which meant an activist government that would spend more to promote equality. The candidates needed only to set off the first step in these networks of meanings. Voters did the rest. Message received. I read an article in the New York Times, and actually I was so fascinated by it, I cut it out. But then someone I live with, I won't say who, seemed to have thrown it out. And but just trying to recall, it talked about how these big loaded words that you hear on the campaign all the time, campaign trail, how they are understood differently by liberals and conservatives. So the idea of the word maybe we hear more than any is freedom. Freedom, 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 freedom. Everything's freedom. So liberals, as I recall from the article, liberals tend to see freedom as meaning freedom from injustice, oppression, freedom from poverty, social freedom. Conservatives tend to see freedom as more of a market freedom, according to this article, the freedom to own guns, the fairness. Fairness is also seen differently, and this gets back to the premise of this Tay Show, that our perceptions are based on our conditioning to a great degree. So if the word fairness, liberals tend to see it meaning economic equality, equal opportunity. It's not fair, a liberal would say, it's not fair that people who are stupendously wealthy should not pay more taxes. Fairness would be seen as in terms of affirmative action, as historically there has been this grievous unfairness toward minorities, and that they, to correct that, to bring it into fairness, they should be given consideration for that in their applications for school and work. Fairness to conservatives would tend to be more fairness means it's only fair that you get to keep the money you make and not have to pay big chunks of it back in taxes. Fairness to conservatives is more of a strict merit-based advancement in terms of education and work. The reason I like this outline of these buzzwords, fairness and freedom, is because it to me it took the right and the wrong out of it, and made me more sympathetic to why there is such conflict, because it's just we're just perceiving things differently. Individualism. He says here, liberals, this is from the book, liberals embrace the individualism of the moral sphere. They reacted furiously against any effort by the state to impinge upon choices about marriage, family structure, the role of women, and matters of birth and death. They embraced policies designed to maximize social freedom. Conservative activists embraced the individualism of the market. They reacted furiously against any effort by the state to impinge upon individual economic choice. They adopted policy prescriptions designed to maximize economic freedom, lower tax rates so people could keep and use more of their money, privatize Social Security so people could control more of their own pensions, voucher programs so parents could choose schools for their children. Probably many writers have emphasized that if you to boil down the wider and wider gap between the liberal perspective and the conservative perspective, it comes down to one way to summarize it is comes down to differing views of the role of government. And that's what Brooks says here. There were two giant idea spaces, a democratic idea space and a republican idea space. The contest was over what mental model would get to dominate the country for the next 4 years, or paradigm. There was an article a long review of a book in the New York Times book review section at the end of September, the review is by Mark Lilla, but the book is called I Am the Change, Barack Obama and the Crisis of Liberalism by Charles Kessler. I'll just read a couple paragraphs here by this reviewer, Mark Lilla. Who is he? Can't find who he is. He seems like a pretty serious academic. And this will be familiar to many people. Whenever conservatives talk to me about Barack Obama, I always feel quite certain that they mean something else. But what exactly? The anger, the suspicion, the freestyle fantasizing have no perceptible object in the space-time continuum that centrist Democrats like me inhabit. What are we missing? Seen from our perspective, the country elected a moderate and cautious straight shooter committed to getting things right and giving the United States its self-respect back after the Bush-Cheney years. Unlike the crybabies at MSNBC and Harper's Magazine, we never bought into the campaign's hollow hope and change rhetoric, so we aren't crushed that, well, life got in the way. At most, we hope for a sensible health care program to end the scandal of America's uninsured, and we're relieved that Obama proposed no other grand schemes of Nixonian scale. We liked him for his political liberalism and instinctual conservatism, and we still like him. But more than a few of our fellow citizens are loathing themselves blind over Barack Obama. This is a fascinating and disturbing phenomenon, that the level of hatred and it's very, very troubling. I'm convinced now even more than when in my Taisho show on racism earlier this year, when I made the same statement, but now I'm more convinced than ever that it's a great deal of it is just racism, just plain and simple racism, which may, for most of these people who hate him so much, may be unconscious. I do think it is unconscious for many of those people. When they say it's not racism, I think they believe it's not racism. But racism is just a form of seeing someone as other. Other. He's not other. That's what's also behind the thing about the ridiculous birther thing. But this reviewer of the book, the author itself, Kessler, of the book that's being reviewed, he makes the point has the opinion that it's just that Obama is just the most recent articulator of a movement of progressivism that began with Woodrow Wilson, went from Woodrow Wilson to FDR to Lyndon Johnson and now to Obama, and they see this is just the most recent disturbing person embodying this what they see as a disturbing trend. The article is the review is unusually long for the New York Times book review section, and unusually dense, I would say. So I'm not going to read anything more from it. It was hard enough for me to process it, much less expecting people to process it, hearing it read aloud. Here's a little nugget, not entirely related to what I was just saying. Brooks observes that in Washington, the highest status went to those who studied things involving guns and banks. People who wrote about war, budgets, and global finance strode around like titans, but people who wrote about family policy, early childhood education, and community relationships were treated like pudgy geeks at a frat party. You could pull a senator aside and try to talk about the importance of maternal bonds to future human development, which is one of the many things he talks about in this book that Brooks is clearly sympathetic to, the importance of maternal bonds to future human development, and the senator would look at you indulgently as if you were raising money for a group therapy farm for lonely puppies. Then he'd go off to talk about something serious, a tax bill or a defense contract. And then one last thing from the Brooks book. He talks about how our healthy social fabric has deteriorated in the last few decades. A cultural revolution had decimated old habits and traditional family structures. An economic revolution had replaced downtowns with big isolated malls with chain stores. The information revolution had replaced community organizations that held weekly face-to-face meetings with specialized online social networking where where like found like. The result was the diminution of social capital that Robert Putnam described in Bowling Alone and other books. People became more loosely affiliated. The webs of relationship that habituate self-restraint, respect for others, and social sympathy lost their power. The effects were sometimes liberating for educated people who possessed the social capital to explore the new, loosely knit world, but they were devastating for those without that sort of human capital. Family structures began to disintegrate, especially for the less educated. Out-of-wedlock birth skyrocketed, crime rose, trust in institutions collapsed. In socially depleted nations, many people began to form their personal identities around their political faction. They had nothing else to latch onto. Politicians and media polemicists took advantage of the psychic vacuum and turned parties into cults, demanding and rewarding complete loyalty to the tribe. In the Newsweek article I read earlier from, they mentioned that Brooks has really fallen out of favor with many conservatives because of his moderation. Once politics became a contest pitting one identity group against another, it was no longer possible to compromise. This was written before the whole Tea Party, you know, pride in non-compromising. Everything became a status war between my kind of people and your kind of people. Even a small concession came to seem like moral capitulation. Those who tried to build relationships across party lines were ostracized. Among politicians, loyalty to the party overshadowed loyalty to institutions like the Senate or the House. Politics was no longer about trade-offs, it was a contest for honor and group supremacy. Amid this partisan ugliness, public trust in government and political institutions collapsed. This fictitious character, Harold, in the book, he says he worked his way through the process of discovering how his basic suppositions applied to the worlds of politics and policy, and he came to lament the fact that the word socialism was already taken. The 19th and 20th century thinkers who had called themselves socialists weren't really socialists, they were statists. They valued the state over society. But true socialism would put social life first. Harold imagined that the cognitive revolution would foster a more communitarian style of politics. There would be a focus on the economic community. Did people in different classes have a sense they were joined in a common enterprise, or were the gaps between classes too wide? There would be a focus on the common culture. Were the core values of the society expressed and self-confidently reinforced? Were they reflected in the nation's institutions? Did new immigrants successfully assimilate? In the political sphere, Harold imagined, conservatives would emphasize that it is hard for the state to change culture and character. Liberals would argue that we still, in pragmatic ways, have to try. Both would speak the language of fraternity and inspire with a sense that we are all in this together. And then he quotes Daniel Patrick Moynihan, "The central conservative truth is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society. The central liberal truth is that politics can change a culture and save it from itself." And then Brooks himself says that everything comes down to character, and that meant everything came down to the quality of relationships, because relationships are the seedbeds of character. Whether you call it, and now I'm saying, whether you call it character or relationships, both are nourished and enhanced and developed and enlightened through Zen practice or any kind of good meditation practice. Yasutani Roshi once famously said that Zen practice is the development of human character, meaning coming to terms with our greed, anger, and delusion, and coming to terms with all of this, what Brooks calls all of this unconscious stuff in the mind. That's one way to understand meditation, is we are, as Freud once said about psychoanalysis, it's making the conscious, making the unconscious conscious. Meditation practice is about awareness, becoming more aware. Very simply, becoming more aware of the mind and what determines how we use the mind and how we see reality, but it's awareness. So from this understanding, Zen practice or meditation practice is indispensable for improving society. One of the points that Brooks would make, I believe, is and many I've read this from other columnists, is how much we have given up on the whole idea of sacrifice, shared sacrifice. Frank Bruni, a columnist for the New York Times, makes this point in a column from late September. He said, the last president to make a truly robust call for sacrifice was ridiculed for it. That president, Jimmy Carter, suggested only that we turn down our thermostats a tad and guzzle a bit less gas, and in July 1979 observed, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Then came Ronald Reagan, whose many great contributions to America were coupled with less great ones, including the idea, which has dominated our political discourse ever since, that we should speak only of mourning in America, that's M-O-R-N, only of mourning in America, and that optimism, like virtue, is its own reward. It isn't, not if it crowds out realism, which we need more of these days. There's such a profound bias in our culture toward optimism and needing to hear optimistic things. And still another column, this is more recent, October 21st, again in the New York Times, there is one by a Scott Shane, a reporter in the in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, called The Opiate of Exceptionalism. Imagine a presidential candidate who spoke with blunt honesty about American problems, dwelling on measures by which the United States lags its economic peers. What might this mythical candidate talk about on the stump? He might vow to turn around the dismal statistics on child poverty, declaring it an outrage that of the 35 most economically advanced countries, the United States ranks 34th, edging out only Romania. He might take on educational achievement, noting that this country comes in only 28th in the percentage of four-year-olds enrolled in preschool, and at the other end of the scale, 14th in the percentage of 24 to 34-year-olds with a higher education. He might hammer on infant mortality, where the United States ranks worse than 48 other countries and territories. The candidate might try to stir up his audience by flipping a familiar campaign trope. America is indeed number one, he might declare, in locking its citizens up, with an incarceration rate far higher than that of the likes of Russia, Cuba, Iran, or China. In obesity, easily outweighing second place Mexico and with nearly 10 times the rate of Japan. In energy use per person, with double the consumption of prosperous Germany. How far would this truth-telling candidate get? Nowhere fast. Such a candidate is, in fact, all but unimaginable in our political culture. Of their serious presidential candidates and even of their presidents, Americans demand constant reassurance that their country, their achievements, and their values are extraordinary. You know, this, surely anyone hearing this Tay Show would agree that this is just a form of egotism. It's just an expanded, bloated form of the specialness of exceptionalism of the self. It's just blown up a bit in terms of my country. He says it is permissible in the political major leagues for candidates to talk about big national problems, but only if they promise solutions in the next sentence. Unemployment is too high, so I'll create millions of jobs, and so forth. Democrats are more loath than Republicans to look squarely at the government debt crisis, indisputably looming with the aging of baby boomers and the ballooning cost of Medicare. Republicans are more reluctant than Democrats to acknowledge the rise of global temperatures and its causes and consequences. But both parties, it is fair to say, prefer not to consider either trend too deeply. As far as the budget deficit, this gets back to the call for more sacrifice, shared sacrifice. I'm really sympathetic to this need to look harder at entitlements and how can we not raise the retirement age, that is the age at which we start to people start to get Social Security checks. How can we not do that, given how much longer people live now than they did when the Social Security program was instituted? But, you know, these politicians, Obama included, just won't go there, won't talk about the need for paring away some of the entitlements that people get. Right. All right. So I'm going to have to wrap this up. One last little thing, and this is a another New York Times column called "Is America Man Enough to Vote?" And this here, I'm just going to throw out. The author here is throwing out a challenge, and this is what they found. Listen to this. They found that testosterone may provide a key to boosting voter turnout. They analyzed the testosterone and the saliva generated by. Test subjects chewed sugar-free gum after they'd voted and again at regular intervals after learning the election results. When the scientists analyzed the testosterone and the saliva generated by all that gum chewing, they noted a dramatic pattern. Men who had voted for the losing presidential candidate, John McCain, suffered a big drop in their testosterone after hearing of his defeat. The scientists reported that the male McCain voters felt significantly more controlled, submissive, unhappy, and unpleasant. The testosterone effect was, quote, as if they directly engaged head-to-head in a contest for dominance and lost. And then they didn't find the same effect for women. Is it possible voting makes male voters too vulnerable? Could the Could the unpleasant feelings male voters experience when their candidate lose discourage them from revisiting the polls? No wonder they stop voting. It hurts too much. So I hope that all of the men who hear this are man enough to take a chance and get out and vote, and that the women will do the same. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows.